Thanks. Welcome to Swerve South.
Hey, everyone. Welcome to the brand new season of Swerve South, Episode 1. And I have a very special guest here today, Mandy Carter, who's been a civil rights activist for 50 years and founder of Southerners on New Ground. Mandy, welcome to Swerve South.
I have to say to you, thank you so much. And I have to say, after all the years of the organizing in the South with Southerners on New Ground, I have never stopped in the state of Mississippi.
We are honored to have you here.
I'm thrilled.
This is terrific. Thrilled. It's been much too long. We hope there will be more visits that are more frequent.
Count on it.
So today, Mandy is speaking with a panel of student activists, and she's going to be visiting Money, Mississippi, and other work. But before all of the public events started, I was lucky enough to get about an hour to chat. And I just wanted to first ask you to talk a little bit about your upbringing and how you got interested in social justice.
Well, one, the first thing I always tell people is that I was born November 2nd, 1948. I mention that because that's our post-World War II baby boomer demographic. But life happens. After I was born, I have a brother, Ronnie, and a sister, Dolores. Our mother got up and left and never came back. So we became wards of the state of New York through the Albany, New York. And so because of that, we were put in a home for unwanted babies, whatever. But right up the street is Albany Children's Home. I was there up until the age of 8. But the home got sold. It is now Russell Sage Junior College. If I wanted to go back up and see where I spent my first 8 years, it would be there.
Wow.
But here's the most important part. From 8 to 12, we were living with a black foster family in Chatham Center, New York. The idea that you would have a black farm family in Chatham Center, New York was extraordinary. But they took us all in. But unfortunately, things kind of didn't quite go the way we thought, and I ended up being sent away to the Schenectady Children's Home, which is about 30 miles from Albany. Looking back on it now, I think the most defining moment is that they put us into the public school system. I don't know if that's what's happening now with a lot of these children's home societies. They tend to bring people in. But I remember in my junior year of high school, Jack Hickey, my social studies teacher, and a shout out to social studies teacher, brought in this young white staffer from an organization called the American Friends Service Committee. Never heard of it, but Quakers. He said three things as to why I'm sitting across from you this morning. The first was just the legacy of the Quakers, a religious society of friends, full equality and justice for all. The second thing he talked about was this concept of the power of one, that each and every one possesses the ability to make what change, whatever. But it was the third thing. We have a high school work camp in the Pocono Mountains who would like to go. I raised my hand, disconnected to children's home, let me go. And it was really like, I don't know if you've ever been to camp, you know, it was maybe about 10 of us, but they brought resource people in. This is 65. But who they bought in were people like Guy and Candy Kerwin from the Highlander Center. The first time I heard the name of Bayard Rustin in terms of who he was. But what caught my attention, Guy and Candy Kerwin are just young white folk singers. That's the time of Joan Baez, Bob Dylan, Judy Collins. But they called themselves cultural workers. And they said what they were doing as white allies to the ever-growing civil rights movement, we're going to go down south and we're going to record the freedom songs in those black churches. We're going to record those meetings that are happening in the black churches. Guy and Candy Kerwin are still, well, most recently, Candy is still at the Highlander Center. But I remember hearing that. And then they said, by the way, if you ever find yourself out in California, Joan Baez just opened up the Institute for the Study of Nonviolence in Carmel Valley, California. To make a long story short, I ended up getting there. And they were just planning at this point, real quick, Vietnam was happening at the time, draft. And they were organizing the first ever nonviolent civil disobedience action outside of the Oakland Induction Center, which is if you were going to Vietnam, you had to go through there. So I sat in with a bunch of other women in December, went to Santa Rita Jail. And in Santa Rita, it's like 99% black women. I mean, what's new? But they asked me, as the lone person of color, why are you here? Like, what are you doing with all these people? I said, we're here because we're dealing with the war in Vietnam. And then the minute I said that, what they said is, oh, my gosh, that's my husband, father, brother, going before a judge. And the judge says, you have two choices, Nam or jail. And what the implications of that are to this day. Anyway, real quick, another woman who was there, Jane Shulman, shout out to Jane Shulman, who was working with WLOS, said, have you ever heard of the Worry Sisters League? No, what's that? Founded in 1923 by three women. And she said, well, we're going to have a potluck. Potluck? Well, would you like to come to a potluck? Well, that potluck I went to meant that was in 67. I got a job in 69. Long story short, ended up going to Durham, North Carolina, because there's an office there. Long story short, ended up now staying in Durham, North Carolina. Long story short, we formed Southerners on New Ground. So that's exactly how my journey
that,
was.
I feel like I just had like a whole history of 50 years
yes,
of like
a,
progressive activism. That was awesome.
Yes.
Don't feel that you have to rush things.
Okay,
all the time
good.
I just
your
no.
journey.
No, no, this is great. That is really cool. I want, if we can pause for a minute. Mm-hmm. I mean, and I love, like, it's such a rich history of the Quakers.
Being
at the front lines. And, you know, Bayard Rustin, we just name dropped.
Yeah,
people.
Yeah.
Can you talk a little bit, for people who may not know, about the Highlander Center and a little bit about, you know, I don't know if you had a relationship with Bayard Rustin.
Yeah, I don't. Well, you know, and this is what's interesting, and it makes me wonder what's not in our books. The fact that I did not know about a Bayard Rustin reading in our books, only to find out, are you familiar with a group called People for the American Way Foundation?
Yes.
Anyway, yeah. Who was the guy who did Ma? Can't think of his name.
I can't either.
Him.
Yes.
But they purposely will put books out to make sure there's things not in it. But by going to the AFSC High School Work Camp, Highlander was, there's the key word, was intentionally started to be a place in 1932 where black and white folk could be in the same space in Tennessee to talk about how they were going to implement change in labor, civil rights organizing. Who went there? Rosa Parks went there. A very young Dr. Martin Luther King went there. And you can name a bunch of other people, too, as well. But when you had that and they purposely met there. So the Highlander Center is still there to this day. Highlander Center, you can Google it. But the intentionality of figuring out, because it's not about black folk and what white folk can do to help us, and it's not about almost feeling as if, be honest, there's some people who are only interested in kind of saving with their own. But Guy and Candy Carowin, I think I was so impressed because they just had this openness about them, and they were trying to figure out how they could do the work. To this day, if you're driving on I-40 going west, Highlander is right off I-40. Hmm. And anyway, so they do institutes. They have a lot of things for young people, youth institutes. A lot of it's around language justice, food justice, where they're located. And after all these years, it sort of serves as a model in terms of how you can do intentional, intersectional, cross-race, cross-class. And then when you go from there, then go out and figure out how to work. And people can host activities there as well. They have an annual gathering every year. Sadly, Guy had passed away. But here's the most phenomenal thing. I met Guy and Candy Carowin at the age of 17. Candy Carowin and I are now in the National Council of Elders together at the age of 70. That journey, but it's not just mine. That's that 60s generation. But yes. What does that say? We looked at each other the other day. We meet at the Alex Haley Farm, which is not far from the Highlander Center in Tennessee. And we looked at each other and said, what are the chances, but maybe not chances, maybe the intentionality of the kind of work we do, why we do it. But if my journey was coming through the Children's Home Society and two foster homes and a children's home, and you're sitting here, then you asked the question, how do we end up in the same space? Like, you know, take the time to share the journey. So I feel really blessed around that. And coming up soon, we're going to have another gathering, you know, and we always talk about that. Bayard Rustin, if people do not know, if they know the words, I have a dream today, one day, August 28th, 1963, he was the architect of that march. And while Dr. King, certainly in all, in terms of the oratory of that was, but someone said, well, Bayard who? But if someone named Bayard who can pull off probably one of the most consequential efforts in a way that means that maybe I can do that too. I mean, I think that's understanding about what little only me can do. But Bayard, he had the same background, who we thought was his sister, who was his mother, didn't know his father. Had a fierce grandmother who was a Quaker up there in Pennsylvania. And I don't know if you heard the news recently, but what was the summer rest in Pasadena back in 1950-something?
Yes.
Something?
I know, you know, he was, in the middle of his work, he was arrested on a sodomy charge.
Yeah.
That you know, haunted him, and they threw it against him all those years and made him. That's one of the reasons we don't know his name. Is
yeah, that
they,
might. Well, that
they
might
hid
be.
His work.
Yeah.
They just took. They just took away that conviction.
Was, unbelievable.
You know, too late, but I'm glad.
Too late,
they did,
but I'm glad right? they did.
But that is so. I just love this
yeah.
history.
Mm-hmm.
You know, there's so much now in the rhetoric is, oh, the South is so hopeless. Mm. The South is so. There's so many of these radical movements. Started here and
I was just
continue
say,
to
and continue
these
to
movements, and we don't see the ways that that continues because it's, you're right, it's not part of the history that we learn.
Well, I have a quick question for you. I mean, when we started, and by the way, I have to do a shout out to our co-founders, with six, and we did it intentionally, by the way, three white progressive Southern lesbians. This is me. Suzanne Farr, who wrote probably one of the best books, Homophobia, A Weapon of Sexism, mm. Little Rock, Arkansas. Mab Segrist, My
yes.
Mama's Dead Squirrel, Durham, North Carolina. Pam McMichael, Louisville, Kentucky, which at the time was working for Jobs and Peace and Freedom. And then three progressive Southern black lesbians, myself in Durham, North Carolina, War Resisters League. Pat Hussein, at the time, was working out of Olympics out of Cobb. And then Joan Garner, who we sadly lost, but was with the Fund for Southern Communities. We intentionally came together and it did kind of a co-director model at a Creating Change conference in Durham. And one of the things we talked about, just what you said, where do you choose to do your work? But when we did our first mission statement, this is what it was, building transformative models of organizing in the South that connect race, class, culture, gender, sexual orientation. That was in 1993. It is now 2020. We've added language justice, food justice, whatever the you know the
yes.
other things might be. But we also intentionally turned over our co-director to another set, Paulina Hernandez and my mind. Anyway, but I think the modeling is good because we'll be 30 years pretty soon. But why is it we're still here? So it's more important about why you do what you do, where you do what you do. But this notion about the South, we believe this, so goes the South, so goes this country.
Yeah.
And if everyone's leaving and people are not staying to be grounded in terms of what that work is, I'm really seeing sort of a Southern. Now, let me ask you this. When I use the term South, what states do you think?
This is always, a place like this is always
yes,
the
best
where they go. So one definition that's used is those who are in the Confederacy, right? Any of those, which includes Texas
that would
in that
be,
realm.
Right.
The border states, quote unquote, that people talk about is
no,
always
would be.
Missouri, Arkansas.
Uh-huh.
Kentucky, yes. West Virginia.
A little bit.
Part of
okay.
Virginia.
All right.
But, you know, what's really interesting, and this is something I learned when I was reading Feminary.
Out of Dirt, yes.
Right? Was Oklahoma, because, you know,
yeah.
And that's what's really cool, is like when you go and read the letters, they had this, they first defined the South, and they didn't even include Louisiana. So my book has that map from their cover, and they didn't include Louisiana or Arkansas, and all my friends at LSU were saying, hello, where? I'm like, look, I didn't draw the map, man.
Yeah.
But
yeah.
they had to learn, and they kept getting these, you know, letters from women, and women from Oklahoma said, excuse me,
wow.
my people came from the South. We were forced out of there. How are we not included in
wow.
the South? And they said,
yeah.
you're right. And they said, okay. And then they had a lot of African-American women who grew up, you know, like Barbara Smith, who
yep,
said,
there you go.
Look, I didn't grow up in the South, but my people did.
That's exactly
how
it.
How can you say that I'm not also Southern? And they said, yeah, you're totally. So they kept getting a bigger and bigger version
of what that
so
might
for me,
be.
The South is less about purity and policing boundaries.
Mm-hmm.
And it's about affinity and relationships. So
yeah.
people who identify with or are part of that, I think, are part of that South.
And what that
mind.
Could be as well.
Right.
Well, the reason why I ask is that when we did that Creating Change conference in Durham, I kind of joke about it, but some of the calls were, these are, you know, progressive lesbians and whatever. I don't think we had the B and T at that point, bisexual.
Right.
Well, is there an airport down there? We are 5-hour drive. We're a 5-hour drive to D.C. Well, will we be able to get regular food? And what are grits? And so we decided that, now wait, y'all.
Listen.
So we said maybe we should do a workshop. But Mab Segrist, a little background. At the time, Creating Change was also run by the Gay and Lesbian Task Force. Irvishi Vaad was the executive director.
Yes.
And she had really talked about this notion of the North America Free Trade Association and expanding the idea of equality beyond just the LGBT. So Mab made this amazing speech around NAFTA and the implications of what that was. So she did that. We did our workshop. And then after we said, well, this went well, maybe we should do something with it. And that became the genesis of what is Southerners on New Ground. And we had someone in Durham, someone in Atlanta in terms of the co-director model. I only raise that because when we thought about, and I just wonder now when we think about movement organizing and why I'm excited about being here on this campus, it wasn't ours to keep. We started to pass it on. What's the pipeline coming in? How do you keep moving it forward? Keep the, and co-director could be 3, 4, 5, 6, whatever it might be. So now we're almost 30 years. It would be 2023. And so coming on this campus and having the ability to be a part of a conversation, not a speech, not a lecture, but talking with you and other folk who are from here, well, what's your level of optimism? What do you think things are going to change? What happens when people, are they here? Do they leave? Do they come back? And we're having that in terms of generational. So I was 17 to meet Candy and Guy at 17 and now sitting in the same room with her at the age of 70. It's extraordinary. But I don't think it's a mistake. I think there's been some kind of intentionality about this kind of a, what do you call it, the 60s movement, whatever,
yes.
Right? You know.
But what I love about this conversation is you as a 17-year-old were nurtured by people who started in the 30s, right?
Mm-hmm.
And we don't always bring that in. It's like, oh, this all happened. But there was a long tradition. And now you're here nurturing that younger generation. And there's so, I have to say, there's so much progressive energy on this campus right now.
I was going
to
ask you. Yeah, yeah.
You know, you've got.
Tell me a bit more.
Well, you know, SASSI, which is Students Against Social Injustice.
SASSI.
SASSI, Students Against Social Injustice, has been very active on campus. They're the ones who really led the push. Well, there's been a couple of pushes.
Like okay.
UMNAACP started this push about 4 years ago to move the Confederate statue from the center of
campus. Oh, is that, did that happen?
That has not happened. It's in process, though.
Oh.
And then it came to a certain point, and to get them to stop flying the Mississippi State flag, which has still
The
Confederate flag.
Yeah.
So that has, they no longer fly that flag.
Oh, is that right?
Was a decision of the university.
Wow.
But SASSI really pushed and had protests that said, we need to move this
statue.
And there was a lot of resistance and a lot of pushback. But what was interesting is this was happened about a year ago. Confederate 901 and some of these white supremacist groups decided to come to Oxford and march in support of the statue. And it was a hugely disruptive thing
campus.
And they ended up really canceling classes and closing it because they came. But the back, in some sense, what they did is unite the campus because it was so clear what it meant. After they came, the faculty senate, the ASB, which was the most surprising thing, staff council all voted to move the statue.
Wow.
And we have a Confederate cemetery on this campus, unusually. So the obvious place is to say, move it there.
Right.
Where it actually is about honoring the dead and not about these other symbols of white supremacy.
Yeah. Wow.
It's been approved by every council, but they've submitted it to the Institute of Higher Learning, the IHL, which is the governing body over universities.
And
in
what
Jackson.
Do they think? What are they going to do?
And, well, they have tabled it. So we don't know where it's going. They seem to be dodging. It went to archives and especially they had to look at the plan and they approved the plan.
Mm-hmm.
As a viable plan. There's a lot of political pressure around this, as you might imagine, but it's in process. And so there is that activism that they have led, but they've also, there is a new union that formed in the last couple of years on campus.
Really?
Even though there's not, you're not allowed to do collective bargaining.
Yeah, I was going to say,
But unions are legal.
Yeah,
and,
interesting.
And a lot of the students have been working on that, and they're trying to develop kind of advocating for folks.
Right.
There's a lot of energy
that's happening here.
And what I love to see is to bring people like you who have not only your experience in your 50 years, but then you learning from the activism.
Yeah, I was just going
to
say.
To see this as a continuity.
I love it.
And what I really love, and if we can talk, I could talk to you all day,
but
I got to let you go to other things in a minute. I really love to talk a little bit about this intentional coalition. Because now especially, I think that is something that's quite fraught. And understandably, I think there's a lot of folks who are just fed up with the cluelessness and I feel like people who would not have the same experiences don't get it. And so sometimes there's these barriers that come up. Could you talk a little bit about how y'all in Southerners and New Brown thought about that, how you dealt with conflicts and how you thought about building those broader coalitions, even when people might have come in with residual baggage from this racist culture?
Well, I like that term. I'm going to remember that, residual baggage. Well, I think, and quite honestly, these are the words that I live with now. How intentional are you going to be and where else are you going to show up? When we started in 1993, one of the first questions was, what's going to be the first thing we want to be engaged in that's not gay and lesbian? Because you remember at the time you had the thing around marriage equality, employment.
Right.
So it turned out, in North Carolina, I'm sure you have it here too, when you had slaves, who was doing all these crops and whatnot? Well, in North Carolina, there's a huge, it's called the Mount Olive Pickle Company. It's all cucumber, all kind of crops. And it turned out that there was this incident where one of the – they had used these really sharp things. One of the farm workers had sliced his leg. He was so afraid to tell anyone because the factory people, they know this. To make a long story short, Valdemar Vasquez from Farm Labor Organizing Committee from Ohio said, we need to go to North Carolina in solidarity. Let's hold a meeting. They held a meeting at the Immaculata Catholic Church, which is right up the street from mine in Durham. And we showed up intentionally, took a seat at that table and said, we want to figure out how we, as the LGBT community, but also of color and Southerners, how can we help? And they said, what we need to do in order to start, and they got a union after 5 years. That's the end story. How do we start negotiating with the owners of Mount Olive? And so we said, well, I think we can bring on our gay and lesbian community, because if anyone knows about equality, it would be us. The first phone call I made, this is a response. Pickles, what's that got to me being a lesbian? I was in tears. Yeah. I said, what? She said, no. And then I realized two things. One, if only you only hear from the nationals that equality is about my equality, gay and lesbian, you're not hearing anything else. But then I remembered, when I lived in San Francisco, I went to Pride. Have you ever been to San Francisco?
Oh, yes.
Pride? You see how they're huge in? One year, the rainbow flags as far as you can see, and then comes a contingent with the bright red black eagle. Farm workers were in our pride. There was Dolores Huerta and Cesar Chavez. I get tears thinking. I said, and then I'm standing there, and someone said, well, what are the farm workers doing at our pride? That was the reverse question of what this woman, you know? And that's when I said, ah, this is why we're here. So it turned out, to make a long story short, Mav and I, they were going to do a walk, literally, from the offices of Mount Olive at the corner of Cucumber and Vine. I kid you not. Those streets are named after Gherkin and whatever. Mm-hmm. We walked to the state capitol. And as we were walking, some of the meetings were all in Spanish. For the first time, we had to put the headsets on to hear Spanish into English. Game changer.
Yes.
You know what I mean? So it's the individual thing that happened to both of us. But just in terms of us understanding that but that meant intentionally showing up at the church, showing up at the march, being willing to be visible and viable, and then keep the continuity. And then at 5 years, they got a union. And we replicated that same model. So intentional, showing up at other people's tables. This can't just be my table, whatever. And then long haul. Who thought in 5 years we'd have a union?
Yeah.
But who thought after 67 years it would happen to Bayard Rustin, we get this? You know, so you have a sense of time frame, right?
Yes, so it's continuity, it's persistence, but I like the fact that you showed up, but you also then asked a question and listened.
Yeah,
right.
Got that good.
You didn't show up and say,
no.
Here's what we're going to do for you,
oh, yeah,
and we
right.
think you should change, mm-hmm. which is always the risk,
yeah.
right?
No, good
was
point.
Was there any resistance to the farm workers, to you coming in?
No, you know, it's interesting because, you know, I've been thinking about this a lot because I'm also thinking about, you know, there's a lot of conversation now about, you know, the civil rights movement. Did white folk have a right to be there or not? And look at the incredible Jewish-black kind of relationship they had. But who gets to ask that question and who gets to make that decision? And some of it is, you know, if you think about Dr. King, he was really more of like, we are a collective we. And if you figure out we're allies, like together or not, you know, what's that hierarchy of oppression kind of thing?
Right.
Some people said, well, and then a lot of it was pushback. And this is why we started the National Black Justice Coalition, PIN. Because some folks said, well, we welcome your participation, whether it's not. No, but we ain't taking that gay and lesbian thing. That's against God's will.
Mm-hmm.
And when you have that from our own community and people, then you have to say, well, what are we going to do about that? And this is that wonderful thing about Domo and organizers is a need fill it. So we created this thing called the National Black Justice Coalition, purposely meant for people like me and others. We get to be the voice for those who cannot be speaking or speak. We get to be the face for those who cannot be seen. But we found out something when we had our first press conference up at the press club in D.C. Only one reporter showed up. And we thought, well, at least we did our thing. Julian Bond calls the next day, president of the NAACP, what can I do to help? Ally, ally, ally.
Yes.
So now we have the National Black Justice Coalition with a long laundry list, the NAACP, the National Council of Negro Women, you know. But then that also means we need to start showing up at the NAACP, whether it's our group or whatever it might be. So, but who gets to decide, are you welcome here? Can we invite you here? But that legacy is just extraordinary. Yeah.
I love that by creating this visible you know, organization, you were able to let allies know you were there, mm-hmm. right? And that's one of the things that we talk a lot about here. You know, one of the things that the ISIM Center did on our fifth year was to start a pride parade in Oxford.
Oh, wow.
There had been one in the 90s.
Oh, my gosh,
but
yeah.
We started it, you know, and it was student-led. Like, we want to do this. And, you know, as usual, you know, what we usually do is when students come with ideas, we're like, let's help you figure out
good.
How to do it.
Oh,
right?
Good.
And that's really where all our great ideas have come from. Mm-hmm. But one of the things that's always been true of our pride parade is that it is open to everyone, allies and folks who identify with the community. And that's because here there aren't enough of us. We cannot have – there will never be enough of us to have a critical mass if we don't build coalitions. And
I totally agree.
And I think that's across the board. So from the first, people were so excited when we invited them and said, we can march in your parade. We're like, it's our parade. Come on.
So
we had
Oxford
Film Festival. It has grown every year. It's got a good mix of folks. And, you know, and what's amazing is – I mean, the first year, I think there was a little handful of protesters who were coming. We didn't know how big it was going to be. It turned out to be like 10 people. It was actually really, I tell the story all the time. This guy showed up and like everyone was there cheering. I thought it was so fun. And he came to the front and he had carefully lettered this sign that said diversity. Diversity was all written in rainbow letters. Diversity is anti-Southern. Like, what does that even mean, right? Like, you know what I mean? But what was funny is, and he showed it to me, and I think he thought we'd see that sign and crumble. And I got to lead the parade that year with Godiva, who's a great drag performer, in the back of the mini that we came over here in.
Wow.
And so we were just waving, we were throwing candy. But what was amazing was they got pushed aside because everyone wanted to come up and see the parade. Like, they were like, get out of the way.
Isn't that neat?
And so people bring their kids to the parade.
See, this is so amazing.
And this is one of those things that it has become part of the community. I always joke, it's like we have the Christmas parade, we have the homecoming parade, and then we have the pride parade.
And now you got the pride parade.
But it's like, this is part of the community. And for me, in the work we do, it's in some sense, it's practical. When you're in a big city, you can just be with like-minded people.
Mm-hmm.
And be in the bubble. But here, we all have to figure out, this is what you're saying, how do we not just ask folks to stand up for us, but how do we stand up for
the other? Quick question for you. Because in Durham and other places, what do you do with the town gown? This campus is huge. And I mean, is there like a community campus connection or not?
It's not as formal as I think it probably needs to be. There's definitely a tension, especially since Oxford is becoming a retirement community, and that has raised real estate prices.
Oh, really?
Yeah.
So people
are
retiring here.
People, they have billed it as a retirement community. It got listed as one of the great places to retire because you've got all the activities on campus.
Right.
And when they built a regional hospital, then they had a good healthcare system close by.
Okay.
So it has really made – and then people are buying second homes as part of the kind of alumni market in the SEC. So it has really raised housing prices and made affordable housing a big issue.
Oh, wow.
And I think there is – I don't know that we've done as well as we need to, but there are people who are sponsoring those conversations, which I love to see, to
Wouldn't
say,
good.
As a university, we bear a responsibility for part of this problem.
Yeah.
We need to be thinking about that.
Mm-hmm.
But there are a lot of collaborations. So we collaborate a lot with community organizations, you know, with Oxford Film Festival.
Oh, good.
And Oxford Arts Council, you know, and there is a – you know, there are a few that are growing, but I do think it can be a struggle – thinking about how you bridge that gap.
Yeah.
Because they're really – and the university, like most universities, is grabbing land and expanding
same thing.
In all those ways. Mm-hmm. And so much of the town depends on, sadly, how our football team is doing. So,
it is.
It's like, so we've been tanking the last 3 years. It's affected the restaurants. It's affected – you know, and it's one of those things that can be a real struggle. So I don't – I think we're trying to do better, but it is something that I think is hard – for people to wrap their minds around, because you get into your tunnel like, my job is to teach, my job is to do X.
Like that.
You know, what we care about is the bottom line of the university, but so much of that larger conversation. I think that's a challenge a lot of places. There are these coalitions that are building, but it can be a struggle. Because there is a sense of like, there's been a lot of sense of like, oh, those folks are changing, or you're bringing in different outsider ideas, you know, and that kind of sense of what's really Southern and what is outsider as in this environment has become, has affected us as well.
Follow-up question for you as well, because we're dealing with it. Today is our first day of early voting in the state of North Carolina. This is the first time we're part of the Super Tuesday. One of the questions that came up was, everyone's interested in sort of the top of the ticket, but when you start thinking about who's making decisions, so we're thinking city council, county commissioners, water, whatever, does the campus have impact? Is it a two-way street? It impacts Oxford and it goes the other way. Am I asking the question?
Yeah, I think it does. You know, and what's interesting is, you know, in terms of students, not all the students register to vote.
That's what
here.
I was going to ask you. Yeah.
Some will,
yeah.
And I think that's something.
And they'll
something,
say register where they live.
Yeah, or they may not vote, which is something we're trying to push through and get them thinking about that realm. I think there's been a push to get people to register here.
Mm-hmm.
What I do know is that, for the first time, there is a law professor who's running for the state senate.
Really?
As a social democrat, right? So and that is, I don't know, and there was a chemistry professor who ran for congressional seat against the incumbent, didn't win.
Yeah.
But you're starting to see there's some of that work that's happened that people are starting to run. But Oxford is a space that is, it's called the little blue dot, really, in the red state.
Within a red state.
But even within the city, there's a mix of that, and so I think you see that influence. But it is, there's a tension with that sometimes.
And you still have
too.
That tension, right?
Yeah, definitely.
We were just talking last night about, and also you just mentioned in the car, but then take Jackson. When you start hearing those kind of stories, I mean, Mississippi has been what, how many people elected? Hello? Yes. But then this, so I'm just wondering, whatever the journey was, and we have a number of Southerners on Song Folk down in, where is Jackson? Am I east?
Jackson, we're north about
north,
2.5
yeah.
hours.
I have a lot of, shout out to the Song Folk in
Mississippi.
Listen,
and we'd love to connect with those folks. I think there's a lot of students here
who
love
that,
to be part of that. So that's something we can think about.
But we were pondering that, about how, what's never been. And in fact, right now, real quick, in Durham, Durham has a huge Latinx community. And for the first time, we actually have a Latina sitting on the city council. Why did it take that long?
Right.
And Durham has a long, strong black community and progressive community. But there's been this interesting team. When people run, they kind of run as a team versus not. It's just not me. And sometimes you have to pit one against the other. We're trying to make some of the changes in the law. Not the law. What do you call the politics of the area?
Right.
But there's been a lot of times, what's the point? We're never going to win. Or you hear things like other national groups, I'll mention no names, don't bother, nothing's going to happen down there. Well, then just write us off.
Mm-hmm.
But here we sit coming up with Super Tuesday, and you have 11 key races in the South that could determine the presidency.
Absolutely.
The U.S. Senate, keep the House, and have to be careful about my partisanship. But it's all those local, state, county.
That affect you in such intense ways.
Yeah.
No, I think that's right. And I love it real quick, and I know I could talk to you all day.
Oh, no,
thank
good,
you for coming. You're in San Francisco, which, just from my research and seeing it, was this haven. It was almost a mecca, right, of lesbian feminism and activism. You had Pat Parker there. You had, Dorothy Allison moves out there. You got this amazing thing. You moved to Durham, and you decide to stay. What was it about Durham that called to you to make it your home?
You just made a good point. It's almost as if, why there were so many Southerners there. Where else you could literally lose your life in the South, no doubt. But that would be true for some other areas as well. Now here's the other point. Because I didn't have any parents, in an interesting way, I didn't have to worry about being out. So I was just black lesbian out in San Francisco.
Right.
But you've been there. That is a very confined area. And when I got there in 1967, at that point, and Vietnam was a big issue, the Black Panthers were starting.
Yes.
But you had 14 lesbian bars, and you had all the boys' bars, whatever. I think the defining moment for me, and I don't want to get too sad about this, but you literally had everyone. You didn't have to see anyone. I mean, when Harvey Milk and George Moscone got murdered on that day down in San Francisco City Hall. Got a phone call, you have to come down to Market and Castro first thing because there's been a shooting and Harvey Milk and George Moscone had been killed. Bring a candle. A lot of lesbians, we got there, we looked at the gay men, we burst into tears. What have we been doing? Why did it take that? And what was so interesting is Harvey's camera store was right on Castro. So in a weird way for us to march down to the city hall, that's the journey he took.
Yeah.
And Then we thought about, wait a minute, if Harvey could say that I can be out, I can be visible. Then you had a lot of lesbians, though, that were also there and very visible as well. And I think at that point we looked at each other and said, if we do not figure out a way how we make this a collective we of our community broader,
yes.
And it's great to have the bars, it's great to have Pride. Pride is the 50th year this year.
Yes.
But unless we start talking about the changing of public policy, then you realize that's where we have to start taking it. And I remember after coming out, and then, of course, Holly Near sang that incredible song that she had done on the steps of City Hall. I guess that was a moment, and I don't know how you feel about this, but it's almost like in the ride over you shared about looking at that bookstore and thinking, what is it? It was just like it got a seed got planted.
Yes.
And that continues to this day. And I think with me, because that, you know, my home, I didn't know this, real quick, I didn't know my mother. I didn't know her name. I knew my brother Ronnie and Dolores. So when I moved to Durham to take a job with the War Registry, I missed the Four Seasons. You know, you don't have that in California. And right. So when I got there, I had to get a driver's license. And I called the Schenectady Children's Home, and they said, well, let's send you all your paperwork. You'll need all that. And for the first time, I knew my mother's name and where she was born. Hmm. Emma B. Privett, born in Edenton, North Carolina.
Wow.
I couldn't believe it.
So it was homecoming.
It was homecoming. But get this, I go to Edenton because, you know, I want to find out more about the Privets. You go down to the county board, whatever you call it.
Yeah.
I said, I'd like to know about the Privets, ma'am, but you want to know about the black Privets or the white Privets? Hello.
Right.
What was I thinking? Right? So, but that journey was also not just for me, but a lot of people, a lot of the gay and lesbians and bi, they're all moving back to the state. We want to go home.
Yes.
We want to come home where we are. And so part of the Southerners on New Ground, doing those conferences in the South, and actually coming into parts of the South intentionally and asking people, once again, what's your journey? Who are you? Where'd you get here? And more importantly, what are we going to do now? So I would say to you, when I go over and do the Yak over at the campus, a lot of that's going to be, and now what? And how? And who and where? On a scale of 1 to 10, this is my scale. My scale is 1, was there any point getting up this morning? 10 is bring it. I am a perpetual 10, and I want to know who else I can be in that conversation with. So, yeah, bring it. Ready.
I love it. I love, I mean, this is starting to happen, that you're starting to get more in-migration to the South. You're getting people coming home. And coming home, metaphorically, their parents or their grandparents from the South.
Ah, there you go.
And they're coming back.
Yeah.
Or they grew up here and left. And
oh, yeah.
Come. I just had a woman come see me at the bookstore who has been in D.C. for 20 years.
What?
And she's here working for the Bloomberg campaign because they're, like, hiring
people. Oh, they're hiring,
people.
Oh, they're hiring left and right.
But she wants to come back to Mississippi and open a bookstore in Columbus.
Are you serious?
Yes. And we had this great conversation about this, and I said, you should do it. Here's what I can tell you about. Here's, you know, this would be wonderful. I talked to a guy who works in my office.
Yeah.
Who went to Mississippi Math and Science School, which is in Columbus. He pulls up the Google map, says, this is the strip she should go to. Like, we're like planning where she should go.
Wow.
I mean, but what's fun about
yeah.
this is, like, you have, I can't tell you, like, when I, and we talked about this, when I opened the bookstore, there we did this little Kickstarter video, and I just, I had no idea. Like, you know, I had a student who was like, I'll take the video because I'm old.
Oh, yeah.
I can't do it. And we talked about our vision for the bookstore, and I made it public, and I just shared it. But what happened was my former students shared it on their social media sites.
Oh, really?
And it just
the word
spiraled. And they all said, and most of them were living elsewhere, but they all said, this is such an amazing thing for my home state. I really want to try. I really want to do that.
Neat.
And we met our goal in 4 days.
Oh, are you serious?
It was crazy. And what I saw was there is this potent network of Mississippi expats who want to figure out a way to come home.
That's,
and they
that's
want to be
amazing.
Able to imagine it. And it, the work that you do and the kinds of coalition willing to say, come back and let's make the South the place it can be and it should be. And we need it to be.
If I had to put a song on here that I – you remember Meg Christensen wrote Song from the South? Have you
yes.
Every time I go – and she said the same thing, time to come home to the South, coming home. I love that. And then, you know, and then also, you know, I wasn't born and raised in the South. I mean, you know, my mom
wasn't.
Can I claim it? Someone said no, unless you were born and raised and you,
Listen, we're adopted Southerners.
Yeah.
We love it. We work here. It's ours.
We're trying. we'll take the South back. And like I said, we're in a moment, and then the census is coming up. That's happening April 1st. So we're in this kind of next 10-year thing, you know, think generationally, and then whatever happens. And I think the other thing I would certainly make sure I put in the mix as well, that power of one thing, I really realize in terms of what that means day to day. I realized, for instance, Mount Olive. I know if I went into the store and I didn't buy Mount Olives and I let them know why, because of the boycott and then finally getting the union. But when a university who has a contract that puts that food in those cafeterias says, we're not going to do business with Mount Olive for this reason. And to this day, there are people wondering, can we still eat grapes? That grape boycott that the farm workers did was probably one of the most unbelievable consequential. And again, because I could choose. If I have to choose where I'm going to buy my grapes, I'll do it, but let you know why. But then also it's just waking up in the morning and deciding. Today I woke up and said, what's the one thing I'm going to do today? Well, I'm doing two. I'm doing your show, and I'll be over there in a minute, and I'm going to go I guess I'm doing some other things on campus, but being available, but knowing what they are, but then inviting people to be a part of it as well. Not just me, figure it out. And also, can I go to where you are? And also about ability, you know, being sensitive to abilities. Mm-hmm. So it's language, how you move around and whatever. But I think I keep myself open to what the possibilities might be and just trying to say, take it all in, and always inviting other people to be a part of the conversation.
What I love at a moment when I think so many people I see are feeling powerless.
Oh, no.
Hopeless. Mm. You've been doing this work every day, 50 years, and say, what can I do today to make the world a better place?
Yep, you got it. Mm-hmm.
Listen, that's like a good place to end. I'm inspired to have you here. Mm. Thank you so much, Mandy Carter. I'm looking forward to future collaborations.
Yeah, I'll definitely be back, and if not virtually, you know, whatever
Absolutely.
That might be. And I think I'm going to be driving to Money, Mississippi. We're going to try to go by your store.
Yeah, I think that's the plan.
Yeah.
So I'm looking forward.
All right,
to
I have
it.
A gift for you, by the way, real quick.
Excellent.
When Song started in 1993, we decided on our 20th anniversary, we would put this amazing book together. Is called Liberation in Our Lifetime, 20 Years as Southerners on New Ground.
That is so cool.
It's little stories of each of the co-founders. It's a gift to you.
Thank you so much. All right, so students, if you come to my office, I will let you look at this, but I'm not loaning it out because this is too cool. Thank you so much.
Not a problem.
All right, well, let me just close. Thank you so much for being here, Mandy.
Thank you.
And thanks, everyone, for listening. We'll catch you next time on Swerve South.
Swerve South! Hey, hey, hey!
Swerve South is a production of the Sarah Isom Center for Women and Gender Studies, with support from the Southern Documentary Project, music and engineering by Tyler Keith.